Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of New Books in Japanese Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. My name is Raditya. I'm your host for this episode. And today we are joined by Dr. Carly Shimizu to discuss her monograph, Overseas Shinto Shrines, Religion, Secularity, and the Japanese Empire. Dr. Shimizu is a postdoctoral researcher at Hokkaido University. But before we get into the book, perhaps we can start with a little self-introduction from you for our listeners who maybe are not familiar with your work.
Well, first, thank you so much, Rarita, for having me on this podcast. And so as you said, I'm Carly Shimizu, and I'm currently a postdoctoral researcher at Hokkaido University. So my main research is about overseas Shinto shrines, so that's Shinto shrines located outside of the Japanese home islands. So that I sort of define the home islands as the pre-Meiji Restoration borders. So that my research does include looking at shrines in places like Hokkaido and Okinawa, but also in Japanese former colonies like Korea and Taiwan, as well as non-Japanese territories like Hawaii and the US. I'm particularly interested in shrines' relation to the question of religion and secularism. So my research is really involved around that. But because this overseas shrines were also closely connected to Japanese imperialism, my research is also really focused on the multi-ethnic question, because an empire is by its nature multi-ethnic. So how did shrines deal with different ethnicities, particularly within the Japanese empire?
Great. So, yeah. Thank you. Okay, that's it. Yeah. We'll get into this term, the home islands, actually, a bit more later. So
Good. That's great.
Yeah, but yeah, thank you so much for sort of sharing that. In this book you explore, as you've mentioned, how sort of secularity and sort of religion are constructed in Imperial Japan, and how sort of that Japanese secularity was sort of reinterpreted and understood through various Shinto shrines outside of Japan. But before we sort of dive into the book, can you perhaps share how this project came to be? What got you interested in this topic?
Yeah. So I've been interested in like Shinto shrines for quite a while, even before I entered graduate school. Particularly like even when I was younger, You could, I'm from Hawaii. And so in Hawaii, we have some Shinto shrines, although I had never been to one when I was little. And there just wasn't any information about them, about Shinto shrines or about, you know, Shinto more in generally. Like you look on the internet, and this was back in the day before the internet was a huge thing it is now. And there's just a lack of information. So when I did enter into graduate school, I knew I wanted to do something about Shinto shrines. And then because, as I said before, I'm from Hawaii, and then I was living in Hokkaido, both of these are sort of on the border of Japan and America, respectively. So I really want to look at Shinto shrines in these sort of like marginal spaces, so to speak. So that's where my interest came from. And then I was really trying to grapple with trying to define what is Shinto. It's a, such a controversial question. And what is religion, which is also a really controversial question. And how shrines related to religion, particularly in the era that I study, the official line by the Japanese government is that shrines were not religion, they were secular sites. And then post-war, the American occupation sort of blamed some of the war guilt on Shinto and saying it was a state religion. And so like the problem with Shinto shrines was not Shinto itself, but the fact that it was a state religion. So if you could separate shrines from the state, then they would be okay. And so I just really this wanted to delve into that question in my research. And that's kind of what led to this book. And of course, from Hawaii and Hokkaido, I expanded out into the other areas where Japan had influence. So again, it's colonies, also it's puppet states like Manchukuo on the Chinese mainland, not technically a colony, but treated sort of similar to it. And then also where there were major Japanese migrant communities. So that's Hawaii, the west coast of the US, and then also Brazil. So that's, kind of, I just really wanted to do something about overseas Shinto shrines because it was such an understudied topic in summary.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you. Okay. I want to start with something that I think is central to your book. And this has sort of appeared, you know, before when you just mentioned, sort of explained about how you got interested. Please do feel free to sort of correct me if I'm wrong, but you're looking at the process of sort of how secularity was sort of established as an important element of the Japanese empire. You know, obviously you're engaging with sort of other scholars like Jason Josephson Storm, and Isumai Junichi, who are sort of also interested in sort of this idea of like, well, what is religion and what is secularity and how sort of the Japanese Empire during the sort of Meiji period sort of create that, you know, those sort of ideas. Can you perhaps provide sort of a brief explanation of what this secularity meant in sort of Imperial Japan? And how is it different from, sort of other secularities, right? And it's a difficult question, I know, but maybe for...
But I'll do my best to explain it as clearly as I can. So basically, the way I define... So there's the question of secularism and secularization. And earlier research basically argued that as the world becomes as the world develops, this sort of like progressive idea of history, like the world develops and becomes better, religion loses its hold, like so superstitious religion loses its hold on society, and societies become more secular. And then generally the example of this was in Europe, where church attendance has continually fallen and people, and like atheism and people stop believing in God and stuff, has grown in popularity. And then America was often used as an outlier because people in America, despite it being a, you know, first world nation, modern liberal democracy, were still pretty religious. Like they went to church and professed faith in Christianity and so on. And then sort of, I mean, America was held up as the exception, but then many scholars looked at a bunch of other countries, particularly non-Western countries, and America's not the exception. Like Europe was the exception. And then, so they're kind of this, like, the secularization hypothesis was sort of criticized a lot. And so from that discussion, the idea of like different types of secularism existing in different countries or different areas was born, so to speak, or was developed. So in the West, we have a sort of liberal secularism, and it's heavily influenced by its Christian roots. So it has certain ideas about time and space and history and all of that sort of thing. But then in other countries, they're going to have different ideas about secularism that are going to be influenced by their own heritage. For example, like a Confucian heritage or a Buddhist heritage, or in Japan, a Shinto heritage. And so we can't talk about there being just one secularism or one secularity. We have to see secularism as a political project that nation states actually built and, like, deliberately tried to instill into their population as a part of the modern mindset. And depending on that country and their various heritages, it's going to be different. You know, it's going to differ. And, like, they all have, like, similarities, right? Like, they're all dealing with, like, time and space. And obviously, yeah. Asian countries were deeply influenced by Western colonialism and so on. But we can't just assume that liberal secularism, as we see in the West, is the universal truth for the entire world, and that we naturally progress towards this more enlightened view of the world. So that's sort of my probably still confusing explanation of secularism.
Yeah, definitely. The so-called myth of disenchantment, right? Like, that we are in sort of a different sort of era, and that after modernity, all these sort of beliefs of like, various different types of, well, not just magic, but like various different types of practices and rituals are just suddenly gone and replaced by science.
That can happen. It's a sort of,
yeah, it's that just that's the thing. It's like that. Yeah. Yeah, no, definitely. For sure. It's a very hot topic in religious studies.
Interesting topic, and it definitely needs more research, and I hope this book contributes to it. But it's a really broad topic that definitely needs more if anyone's listening wants to do research in the area.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, thank you so much. Before we sort of go deeper in the book, just sort of going back to the introduction, right? Sort of this term, the home islands that you use a lot in the book. Do you mind explaining? Well, you've sort of mentioned what this sort of what you mean by this earlier, but why did you choose to sort of use this term instead of, well, either, like, you know, the Japanese islands or something like that? But
Home islands. Yeah.
Yeah.
I debated about it, to be honest. I live in Hokkaido, and even today in Hokkaido, when we talk about Honshu or Kyushu or Shikoku, we refer to it as Naichi. So that's like the inner land. And that term comes from when Hokkaido was settled by Japanese migrants up here. Because Hokkaido was not a part of the inner land. It was a sort of like colony or a sort of like frontier land. And so, again, it's still used today here in Hokkaido. It's not used by people living in Naichi, so to speak. So I was trying to find a translation for that term, and I settled on home islands, which sort of draws parallels to British imperialism, I suppose. Because that's like the home islands of Japan included only those three islands. And then you had Gaichi, like the outer lands, which referred to the colonies. So that'd be like Taiwan and Korea and so on. So I felt it was really important to get into the mindset of people during this period that I'm studying, in that they don't see Hokkaido as an integral part of Japan yet. It's still a frontier land. And same with Okinawa, although I don't talk a lot about Okinawa for various reasons in my book. So that's why I chose to use basically the historical terminology rather than adopt a post-war view of Japan, which sees Hokkaido as an integral part of Japan. Like, that was not how it was seen before the war.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Interesting. Okay. Well, that was all chapter one, actually. And in chapter two, for those who have not read the book. In chapter two, you discuss Koshihara Jingu as a case study. And one of the most visible institutions sort of promoting, well, this version of Japanese secularity. You focus on three aspects of the shrine that sort of help in this effort, historical, sort of modern, and public. Can you talk a little bit more about this, sort of why these three sort of particular aspects, and why are they important in sort of understanding, this type of secularity?
Yeah, so I really wanted to look at what separates a legally secular site and a legally religious site, because I'm arguing basically that shrines in this period were treated as secular sites. They weren't secretly religious sites that the government was just saying they were secular. The government actually treated them as secular sites. So what differentiates those two spheres is secular sites are for the public. Like anyone should be able to visit them, just like a library or a city hall or a public sports stadium or public park. While religious sites are private, so only members are really supposed to be visiting them. And this is actually, you can even see this today, with the exception of really famous Buddhist temples, which anyone can go visit. Generally, a Buddhist temple is meant for its member families. Like I can't just go to a Buddhist temple in my small little town and sightsee. That would not be appropriate because it's a private site. But shrines, I can do that because shrines are public sites. And then another element besides public was also that they were historical sites. So particularly within the home island, so like at Koshihara Jingu, shrines were founded at sites which were connected or had some sort of significance to a historical figure. During this period, kami, by the Japanese government, kami were seen as real historical figures. So Amaterasu is not a mythical sun goddess. That's not how they talk about her. They talk about her as the imperial ancestress. She is the real, literal ancestress of the imperial family. And so, again, with Koshihara Jingu, which venerates Emperor Jimmu, so nowadays, most people probably would say that he doesn't exist. Or if he does exist, he's kind of like a composite of several different, possibly, historical people. Like, there was no guy literally named Emperor Jimmu, is what most scholars would say nowadays. But during this period, they were like, no, Emperor Jimmu, he was a real person. Here are the historical records. This is literally the place he built his palace. And so the whole goal of the shrine is to commemorate a historical event and a historical person. And again, this contrast in with religious sites, which are more focused on transcendent figures that didn't physically walk in the land. Finally about modern. So, again, it has to do with this older idea of religion being sort of antiquated or something that will be eventually evolved out of. So religion is the sort of thing that a lot of people secularists and atheists were it's just an old superstition that we don't need anymore. But if they looked at shrines like that, that would be very bad because shrines were the basis of the Japanese state's legitimacy. So shrines had to also be a part of modern Japan. And in my book, I look at only modern Japanese shrines, so shrines built after the Meiji Restoration. All the shrines I look at are new, basically relatively new. Although they're doing sort of ancient rites, ancient Shinto rites, they were also integrating modern technology and modern elements to it. The Meiji government, they really wanted to modernize Japan. That was a major part of the big project. And Shinto shrines were part of this modernization effort. So they weren't meant to be a site where, how can I say it? That's very antiquated and only in the past. They're meant to be a part of the modern day world with trains and electricity and that sort of thing. So I basically chose these three elements because I felt they were very important for differentiating showing how shrines were treated as secular sites, just like public parks and that sort of thing, in comparison to religious sites during this period. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Very interesting. Okay. In addition to sort of those three aspects, in sort of many of your case studies, you would include a discussion on space and time as well. Those two sort of help, in sort of constructing, sort of a reality, right? Of sort of this reality built upon this concept of Japanese secularity that is antagonistic to Western secularities. Can you sort of maybe go through sort of this misunderstanding or why this is sort of important?
So I sort of identify space, time, and ethics as the three elements of secularity that I look at in this book. Obviously, secularity is a huge topic, so there are other elements as well, but those are like the three major ones that I look at. And so in particular, you would think that space and time, like these are just scientific facts, right? Like we can just like use science and understand them. Yeah. And that's true whether you're in Japan or in, you know, Europe. And that's not actually true. Like our conceptions of space and time, and of course ethics as well, depend on, are culturally influenced, we can say. So in like the maps are a really easy example. So if you grow up in America or Europe, if you look at the world map in your classroom, you know, England is in the center of the world map, right? And you can clearly see America, like the American continents on one side, Europe on the, sort of in the center, and then we have like the rest of Asia. And like, I'm from Hawaii, so Hawaii is often like in a little box put outside because no one cares about Hawaii. I mean, in the West, you know. But in Japan, instead of having that like Britain or that like European centric idea of a world map, they sort of turned it around and put Japan in the center, Japan and the Pacific Ocean in the center. And then, you know, it was the American continents and Europe, which are pushed to the side or cut in a weird place. So how we envision space depends on how we're taught as kids, basically. And it's the same thing with the number of continents. You would think that the number of continents would be a scientific fact, right? Like when I was a kid in America, I learned that there were 7 continents. But if you actually look at the map, you're like, actually, not really, because Europe is not its own continent. Like, wait, what? You know? And so Japan didn't adopt that 7-continent system because it's obviously like Eurocentric. And so they made their own version, which again, really emphasized Japan and the Pacific. It gave like the Pacific region as its own section. It's not a continent literally, but its own section in the idea of continents and so on. And again, it's the same thing with time. Like when does time start? Like when is the start of history? In the West, we learn it as like AD or CE, like Common Era. But the reason we choose that date is because that's when Jesus was traditionally born. So that's clearly Christian-centric. Whether you say after death or Common Era, it's still Christian-centric. Yeah. And Japan doesn't want to use that calendar because Christianity really isn't that connected to the Japanese state. So they chose the start of Jimmu's reign, of Emperor Jimmu's reign, right, which started at Kashihara, as the start of history. And before that, you know, you start measuring backwards. So I wanted to use Kashihara Jingu as an example to show how the Japanese state deliberately tried to create this different sense of space and time and ethics as well, to that was similar to the ideas that they're importing for the West, but deliberately said like, no, we didn't start, like our history doesn't start when Jesus was born. It starts even before that. Like we're even older when Emperor Jimmu started his empire or whatever. So they're sort of trying to one up the Eurocentricity of the, you know, Westerners who are introducing the idea.
Yeah, it's interesting. Because I guess if you want to promote a particular narrative, it's not complete if you don't create a system that supports that, right? All the way to space and time and sort of history and your understanding of what is real and what's myth, what's history and what's not.
Yeah, these fundamental parts of how we conceive reality. When I was a little kid, I never thought about, when does history start or why we have daylight saving time in some places and not in others, these things we take for granted as children.
Yeah.
But when we start thinking critically about it, these things are deeply influenced by the sort of nationalism, the sort of secularism that we grew up in.
Definitely. Thank you. Okay. In chapter three, your focus sort of shifts up to Hokkaido. And Sapporo Jinja had similar properties with sort of Kashihara Jingu in the sense that, it's also a modern sort of public sort of historical site. How was it different though from sort of Kashihara Jingu, particularly sort of because at the time sort of Hokkaido was not, as you mentioned, right, it's not Japan in the strictest sense. There's trying to incorporate sort of Hokkaido into the Japanese Empire. If you can sort of maybe talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so the difference, I sort of use Kashihara Jingu as this example of this is what's happening with modern shrines in the home islands. And then I want to compare and contrast that with what's happening at shrines outside of the home islands. Sapporo Jinja is my sort of first example outside of the Japanese home islands. And the big difference, or like the most obvious difference, is this shrine is founded by the Meiji government, and it's dedicated to the three pioneer kami. So these are three kami that are kind of combined into one seat, so they're also kind of one kami. Two of them are historical, they would call them historical, old classical kami from the Japanese classics that are associated with sort of making the land. And then one of them is Okunitama, and he is literally the land of Hokkaido itself as imperial land. So this kami, these three pioneer kami are really meant to help develop the land, like this sort of virgin land. Of course, there were Ainu people in there, but the image at that point was Hokkaido as this empty virgin wilderness into a proper part of Japanese imperial land, like a productive part of Japanese imperial land. And it went through quite a few stages. It was because it was founded right after the Meiji Restoration. So it went through a stage where it was promoting the great, the great teachings. And then the Japanese government abandoned the great teachings campaign or the great promulgation campaign. And then they had to stop promoting those teachings because that was too religious-like. And also they had to stop doing funerals because that was too religious-like. It became firmly located to the secular sphere like that. But what is really important about Sapporo Jinja is that it sort of became the model for other colonies' major shrines. So it was sort of like modern Japan's first overseas Shinto shrine that was sort of transplanted to other places like Karafuto and Taiwan.
Okay, yeah, interesting. Speaking of colonies, in the next chapter, you go to Taiwan and you take the readers to Taiwan. Taiwan, I often think, is a very interesting sort of case. Because again, just the shrines instead of the home islands instead of in Hokkaido, they still maintain sort of this characteristic as modern, secular, and sort of public. But with Taiwan, what I find sort of particularly interesting is Shinto has sort of reached beyond shrines with the Takasago, for example. Can you maybe perhaps talk a little bit more about this? What happens? What happened in sort of the Shinto shrines in sort of Taiwan?
Yeah, so with Taiwan's main shrine, Taiwan Jinja, at the very end it became Taiwan Jingu, But it's basically a copy of Sapporo Jinja. So it enshrined the three pioneer kami. And then they also added Prince Yoshihisa, who was a member of the Japanese imperial family who died of malaria in Taiwan as part of the pacification campaign. But it was actually the second shrine founded in Taiwan. The first shrine to be founded in Taiwan after Japan took it over as a colony was Kaizan Jinja, which is really fascinating because this was actually a Chinese ritual site. And the it enshrines Koshinga, who was a half Japanese, half Chinese, like merchant pirate. And he was loyal to the Ming dynasty in China. So he was mainly Chinese. But basically the Japanese governor of Tainan, the new colonial governor, he came and he was like, we should make this site into a proper Shinto shrine. And so they added Shinto elements, but they kept a lot of the Chinese elements. So there's this great video of its annual festival, and it's got like Chinese-style palanquins bouncing up and down and like Chinese-style flags and great Taoist music and everything, in addition to the more somber Shinto-style ritual. Likewise, they kept the building. Like, they didn't tear down the building and build a new shrine or anything like that. They kept the Chinese-style building, and they just added Shinto elements like a purification basin and a torii, like a torii gate. So here, Shinto is not, it's not exclusive to home island-style customs or home island kami. Like, yeah. Taiwanese kami are seen as becoming Japanese kami because Taiwanese subjects, Taiwanese people, became Japanese. So in the same way, Taiwanese kami became Japanese kami. And they also wanted to do this, wanted to use Shinto to help sort of civilize. That's kind of, I mean, again, it's terrible to say it like that, but that was the mindset back then, to like civilize the Takasago, like the indigenous Taiwanese people. And again, they weren't so concerned about assimilating them, so to speak, but more just like civilizing them so they could keep some of their older customs, like they could keep their older rituals as long as they weren't considered beyond the pale. So headhunting, like that was a little bit too much. Like, they're like, you can't do that anymore. However, other things like indigenous clothing or indigenous dancing, they're like, yeah, you can do that as the shrine. And in fact, some Japanese policemen would advocate for that because they felt if they allowed the Takasago and the indigenous people to keep some of their customs, then they're more likely to embrace the selected Japanese customs that they were trying to get them to embrace. So there's sort of an image of Shinto shrines in the Japanese Empire as being really focused on assimilating the imperial subjects. So like, oh, you have to be just like Japanese people. But actually, we don't see that at shrines. Like, there were Japanese officials, of course, strongly advocating for that and persecution of indigenous customs and so on. I'm not saying that didn't happen, because it did. But in the case of shrines specifically, a lot of Shintoists overseas were really happy to include and sort of subsume. So they're treating them as second class, but they're saying they're still permissible as a part of a sort of like Taiwanese-Japanese identity. And that's something that actually surprised me, because when I went into the research, I had that sort of older view of Shinto shrines as being sort of one-way assimilation pressure. But that's not really what was happening in Taiwan and other places.
Yeah, that's interesting. Because, I mean, the entire sort of system, constructed through sort of the shrines, sort of this understanding of, like, space and time that, you know, we were just talking about, like, a few minutes ago, that, you know, mainly applied to Japanese people, right? And now, you have, like, this shrine outside. Well, then, these people, they have to be Japanese as well for us to be able to sort of apply the system to them. And then, I guess, we have all these, sort of just negotiations between, you know, local customs, local traditions, and then what sort of the Japanese government sort of brought through the shrines.
I think something that like we can say is that like to be Japanese wasn't to be like a home islander during this period. To be Japanese was sort of like this ideal that home islanders could more easily be like that. But even home islanders, like so like act like ethnic Japanese people in the home islands, even they had to do some work to become good Japanese citizens. So just because you assimilate to home island customs, that doesn't make you a good Japanese citizen. Like being a Japanese citizen was something not limited to just the home islands. And so especially with the Takasago, who were really great help in World War II and so on, like a lot of them were really praised for being like ideal Japanese citizens, not because they assimilated, because they didn't, but because, you know, they gave their life for the Japanese emperor. And well, yeah, anyway.
Yeah. So yeah. Quite fascinating. Yeah, no, definitely. Very, very interesting. Okay. Yeah. Thank you. So in the sort of the last chapter, you take the readers to Hawaii. Yes. Which in many ways, you know, was different to other case studies. And Hawaii, too, was really interesting for me, because I remember you gave a talk about this sort of particular sort of the Hawaii case at Kyudai. And back then, I didn't even know that there are sort of, you know, shinto shrines outside of Japan. And I was just like, oh, this is a, you know, it's a very interesting sort of idea that I just completely sort of missed, I guess. So most while... Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, because the shrines, you know, they were sort of considered as secular sites, sort of maintaining the same understanding with sort of shinto shrines and sort of the home islands. But because they're not located in Japan and not in sort of any, you know, in sort of any of the colonies, this led to sort of some, I guess, discrepancy with sort of their legal status, right? With sort of the case of the Hawaii Izumo Taisha, for example. Do you mind sort of going over some of these issues that shrines in sort of Hawaii face because they're not in Japan anymore?
So Hawaii is a really interesting case study because you have a majority Japanese population there. So there's over 40% of the population in Hawaii is ethnic Japanese. Some of them are Japanese Americans, so dual citizens. But the ruling class, so to speak, are white Americans. Hawaii is an American colony at this point, a territory. But they only make up a very small percentage of the population. And then the rest of the people there are different ethnicities, including Native Hawaiians, but also Chinese and Portuguese and so on. But anyway, there's this sort of a strong Japanese element to, like, social into society in Hawaii. However, again, because the ruling class, so to speak, is white Americans, like, they're living under a sort of legal American secularism. And Shinto in the liberal secularism of that period, it's either a superstition, like what weird gods and like weird rituals and weird dress and whatever. Which is, you know, very negative image, or else it's a religion. And so because America values religious freedom, a lot, like being a religion in Hawaii would give shrines various rights and privileges, not just tax benefits or whatever, but also, you know, protection under the law. So a lot of shrines, even as they adopted this sort of Japanese secular conception of shrines, they also registered as religious organizations. And one of the examples that I give in my book, which I think is a really nice encapsulated example, is a business card of one of the shrine priests or ritualists. Yeah. And it's in Japanese and English. And in Japanese, he has two titles. He's the head of a sect Shinto branch. And he's also like the head ritualist of the shrine. So he's serving both as a religious Shinto functionary and also as a secular Shinto functionary.
Yeah.
But in the English part, he's only got one title, Reverend, so a religious title. So we have these sort of two more complex conceptions in the Japanese language, but when it gets translated into English, it sort of gets collapsed into a single religious category. So we can see this sort of translation of the Japanese secular sphere being translated into the American religious sphere. I also want to talk about how, particularly in the 1940s, when Japanese in Hawaii were really concerned about like proving their loyalty to America due to the war tensions. Yeah. You did see some of this, like some Shinto, secular Shinto rites being transferred to American figures. So like school children being asked to bow before the portrait of George Washington and George Washington and King Kamehameha. So these are the founders of America and the Kingdom of Hawaii, respectively, being venerated as kami. And so we also see some of this, again, secular Shinto being applied to the American state. But even more than that, Shinto was sort of translated into the American religious sphere. And that became really important post-war, which I don't know if you want to talk about it later or not. But in the post-war, the American government confiscated all the Shinto shrines in Hawaii because they're like, these are secular Shinto sites. So these are basically enemy territory, like from the government. And the shrines had to go to court and argue like, no, we're not secular sites. We're religious sites. We've always been religious sites. We have these connections to sect Shinto, which is religious Shinto. And they won that court battle. And so that's why not most of them, but some shrines were able to revive post-war and get their land back from the government, the American government.
Yeah, fantastic. That actually connects really well to my next question, which is sort of probably also going to be our final one. So just to sort of close off our sort of conversation, I was wondering if you can maybe talk about the legacy of these shrines, right? I'm more on the sort of contemporary side, so I'm sort of very interested in sort of the, I guess, you know, what happens now with sort of these overseas shrines, especially, you know, in sort of the popular imagination, you know, Shinto has always been understood as something that is specific to Japan. And, you know, obviously through your sort of book and through your case studies, you've demonstrated how there were attempts to sort of create an image of Shinto that is not just modern and secular, but also universal to a certain extent, with sort of, Hawaii and Taiwan and all that, right? Yeah, you mentioned a little bit about what happened in Hawaii post-war. What about sort of in sort of Taiwan or in sort of Manchukuo or in sort of any of these other sort of overseas shrines? What happened after after the war?
Yeah, so it's really interesting because so after the war, there was this idea of state Shinto being guilty for Japan's war aggression. And so there was a decision whether to just abolish all of Shinto shrines, like close them down, can't do them anymore, or else they could be continue existence as religious sites. And so the American occupation decided that shrines can be religious sites, as they just have to cut all ties with the government. And so if we have shrines overseas, like, shouldn't they be able to continue as religious sites as well? Like, what about, like, in Hawaii and so on? And what we find is that shrines within Japan's post-war borders, so that's the home islands and Okinawa and Hokkaido, shrines were able to easily become religious sites. Like, even Hokkaido Gokoku Jinja and Yasukuni Jinja, which are really connected to, like, war related rituals, they were allowed to become religious sites, private religious sites. However, all the shrines overseas weren't allowed to become religious sites. For example, in Korea, there were actually people in Korea who wanted to turn one of the shrines, Keijo Jinja, into a religious site, but they were like, no. You're not allowed to do that. We're going to tear it down. And so they tore it down. The Japanese government tore it down. And the American government gave permission for the Japanese government to tear it down. And because these were considered secular sites, these lands and assets were handed over to the new government. So in the case of Korea, the new South Korean government, in Taiwan, it was the Republic of China. And again, Taiwan is a really interesting example because the Republic of China, it didn't have a lot of money. So it actually used these shrines, like the buildings and everything. They didn't tear them down. They just used them for new purposes. And a lot of them became what they call martyr shrines. So basically war memorials for Chinese war dead rather than Japanese war dead.
Yeah.
And they also use them for other things like schools and like become a library and so on, and went through various iterations and so on. And well, in comparison, Korea, generally the Korean government just tore everything down and didn't reuse the sites much. But yeah, but in other cases, well, anyway, well, I won't go into Monte Cuo because I don't think we have time for that. That's also really, really interesting, unique study. But please read my book if you haven't yet.
Yes, please do. Yeah. I'm very open listening.
But in comparison, then in Hawaii, again, the shrines were confiscated as secular sites, but then a court battle allowed shrines to regain that land. Some shrines, about, well, I often say eight, but I don't, some of them are not really active anymore. It's a really difficult situation in Hawaii, like financially for shrines. And actually Brazil is also a really interesting case because there weren't many shrines built in Brazil pre-war because the Japanese government prohibited it because they didn't want to get on the bad side of the Catholic society. But post-war, a lot of the Japanese migrants started building a bunch of Shinto shrines, but they tended to be more religious in character than we saw in the pre-war. So it's quite interesting because in Brazil, it's really the post-war that you see a boom in shrine building, so to speak. I hope I answered your question there.
Oh, yeah, no, definitely. I mean, it's really interesting because, I mean, you know, from sort of our conversation today, sort of from your book, I think it really shows how, you know, in sort of all these sort of Shinto shrines in pre-war times, just because how closely connected they were to Imperial Japan, sometimes they maintain maybe more than one sort of conception of sort of secularity, right? And then depending on the site they are in, people sort of interpret them in different ways, understood them in different ways. And once the Japanese Empire, fall, that just completely, it was just completely destroyed and replaced with something else. Interesting. Or turned into something else, I guess. Well, thank you so much for sort of this enlightening conversation. I'm afraid we've taken way too much of your time. Before we say goodbye, maybe can you sort of share what project you're currently working on?
So, I mean, even just before you mentioned how, like, with the fall, with war, with Japan's losing the war, the situation completely changed for overseas shrines. And so that's kind of what I'm interested in now. So I've, again, in this book, I've really talked about all of the Shinto shrines across the Japanese sphere. And up until the end of the war. But from now, I want to look more into former Shinto shrines, so shrine sites, and how they were used and how people interpret them. Again, to use Taiwan, I've talked about Taiwan a lot in this interview, but so you have sort of the sites are often contested. So for the Republic of China, so people who support the sort of one China idea and see Taiwan as a Chinese place, Shinto shrine sites tend to be seen as a symbol of like a past embarrassment, like the past colonialism and like a great embarrassment. But for people who advocate for a more independent Taiwan, they tend to see Shinto shrines as a part of Taiwan's multicultural past. So Taiwan has been colonized by many people. So like like the Dutch and the Spanish and the Chinese and Japan, of course. So they see shrines as just one part of a multi-ethnic past. So I'm very interested in how shrine sites have sort of been used in different contested narratives about national heritage. And I'm also interested in post-war overseas shrines as well. It's really interesting to see how post-war shrines pick up different narratives from the past. So some of them tend to have a more religious narrative, while others tend to be more on the secular side. And so I'd be really interested in seeing how Shinto shrines founded post-war also dealt with this connection between religion and secularism. So, but again, I'm just starting my research into those areas. So hopefully some good stuff will come out of that.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that definitely sounds like a very interesting project. For those interested in learning more about sort of overseas Shinto shrines, please do check out the book. And please do look forward to Dr. Shimizu's next project. And I will see you next time. Bye bye.
Thank you so much for having me.